看来我们只能靠自己了。
地球错失了最后逃命机会。
这座宫殿不是庇护所。
我觉得彭院长还是霍南大人，你们女的都没。
Hi everyone and welcome to Middle Earth, your source for insight into China cultural industry. Listen to those who are making a living by creating and distributing art or content onto the world's second biggest cultural market. I'm your host, Aladin Faré. Today we wrap up our dark series about China guilty pleasure. After pornography and drugs, we are going to tackle gambling. When I started researching this dark series, I never thought it would actually end up being my favorite topic. If any of you, dear listener, wants to write a crime story, I think that today's episode would be really good for you. Gambling, like pornography and any recreational drugs, is also forbidden in mainland China, apart from tiny exceptions like the national lottery and informal playing between friends. But when borders were opened prior to COVID-19, a great amount of Chinese tourists went gambling overseas in places like Macau, the Philippines, or Cambodia. According to the Chinese International Travel Monitor in 2016, quote, Chinese traveler spends their money in casino and gaming, followed only by shopping, dining and sightseeing. To have casino and gaming was also listed among important hotel facilities to Chinese travelers. Unquote. Yet, did the pandemic actually stop the love of gambling for Chinese public? To talk about this with me, three guests, all joining us from various places all around Asia. So first, Alan Robles, hello.
Yes, I'm Alan Robles. I'm a foreign correspondent. I work out of Manila and I write for the South China Morning Post, and I'm a correspondent for RTHK. I've written about gambling from the point of view of the Philippines and the Chinese gambling companies here.
Next to you in the chat box, but on the other side of Asia, in Australia, Ben Lee, hello.
Hi, Aladin. Thank you for having me on the show. So I run a boutique gaming consultancy called iGamix Management and Consulting Limited, based in Macau. We have conducted all sorts of studies and research, not only in Macau, but around the whole region, ranging from feasibility studies in Cambodia, Myanmar, Laos, to South Korea, Saipan, Philippines, and even as far as the Bahamas. And we have a list of who's who's in terms of clients. And we are always interested in analyzing and evaluating the potential outcomes of any developments involving gaming in Asia.
And a few hours drive, I think, away from you, Sebastian Strangio, hello.
Hi, Aladin, thanks for having me. My name is Sebastian Strangio. I am the Southeast Asia editor for The Diplomat magazine. And I was based in Southeast Asia for about 10 years, during which time I took an interest in some of the illicit gambling operations that have sprung up around China's southern border, particularly in Myanmar and Laos, but also in Cambodia, where I spent many years. And so, you know, I'm here to sort of discuss some of what I've seen in these enclaves and regions.
Let me remind you that Middle Earth is produced by China Compass Production, your production service in the Middle Kingdom. So if you need to find location scouting for your next movie or bring your YouTube channel to Chinese platform, you can reach out. Also, Middle Earth is part of TWC, the World of Chinese podcast network. The World of Chinese is a bi-monthly English magazine dedicated to Chinese language and culture. TWC takes a modern theme and looks behind the headlines to uncover how contemporary issues affect Chinese society. The latest issue, Access Wanted, delves into Chinese society to struggle to become more inclusive for people with disabilities. It also looks at the discrimination faced by students of technical school in China who don't have high school or college degree, and the effort to combat animal abuse in China. To learn more, go to theworldofchinese.com or check the podcast description for a direct access to insightful content about China. So first of all, can we take a step back and just know what are the laws regarding gambling in China? What can you do and cannot do?
Anti-gambling is seen as part of the core tenets of the Communist Party. As a result, they are death on gambling. But China is not the only one that is anti-gambling in that sense. South Korea is even more anti-gambling than China. So similar to China, South Korea has this prohibition against their nationals gambling, not only within their own country, but outside as well. And they're the only country that have actively pursued their nationals who have been caught on video gambling overseas. But where they do differ from China is that they do have one singular outlet called Kangwon Land in Korea that is available for the Koreans to channel their demand or their penchant for gambling. in every other country, Thailand, Myanmar, Laos, and even Cambodia, the locals are not allowed to gamble. But I'm sure Sebastian can tell you differently that although the locals are prohibited, they do, local gambling do occur in Cambodia and all these other countries.
Well, it certainly seems like, you know, the Chinese government's policy of using Macau as sort of a safety valve for this pent-up demand for gambling entertainment is not sufficient, you know, because, you know, I've seen regions of the sort of China Southeast Asia borderlands where there have been, you know, sort of illicit gambling enclaves and entertainment zones that have been established that have drawn in, you know, many hundreds of mainland Chinese from across the border, very often illegal border crossings. The first of these sites that I witnessed was in a small town called Mong La in Myanmar's Shan State, which is under the control of a rebel group. Interestingly, a rebel group that was once part of the Burmese Communist Party before it collapsed in 1989, but since then has been forced to make its money through, you know, to be self-sufficient. And one of the paths they've chosen is gambling. It is interesting in these areas, you know, they run entirely on Chinese currency, Chinese electricity sources, Chinese cell phone networks, and most of the clientele that I saw in the casinos in Mong La in 2014 were mainland Chinese from across the border, very often crossing illegally and then crossing back. You know, it seems like, you know, there is sort of this unsatisfied demand for gambling entertainment, which a range of illicit operators have sprung up around Southeast Asia to try and service.
Absolutely. And Mong La, as you said, you know, was a real Western a cowboy town, and certainly there were, I think at one stage, very close to about somewhere around 50, 60 casinos of all different sizes and makeups that exist in that region. And it's not just Mong La. There is also on the Vietnamese-China border, Lao Cai and Mong Cai, which again also depend on the Chinese crossing the border.
Just to take a step back, what you told me during our pre-interview, Ben, that was really interesting, is that like how Chinese culture sees gambling. And you said that the way the Chinese population sees gambling is actually really different from like the Western people. Like, can you explain why and how?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's brought home or reinforced yesterday when I was out with a bunch of Australians at a local pub, and they were talking about going to our local casino here in Melbourne, Crown, where, you know, they'll spend $20 on a table and have a really good time. And they don't mind losing that money. So in terms of a comparison, your typical Australian or American, let's say they have a budget of $100, they will spend $30-$40 on drinks, on alcohol, $30-$40 on the food, and then $20 on a table, and basically, you know, go home feeling very happy and sated. The Chinese, on the other hand, have a very different outlook on gambling. They would go to a casino with the same $100, spend $5 on food and $95 on gambling, because they don't view the $95 as entertainment. It is a financial investment on which they believe they can make a return. And in fact, one of the most popular saying whenever the Chinese or the Cantonese, when they go to gamble in the casinos in Macau, is just before they start the table, they will say, Hoi Kong. Hoi Kong is Cantonese for let's start work. They are prepared to invest countless hours learning about the way of interpreting the patterns that they think they see in the game of baccarat. And once they think they've mastered the art of reading the patterns, they then believe they can generate a return. And for that, they're willing to spend hours and hours on the table, and basically more money than a typical Westerner or Australian can contemplate putting across the gambling table. So this is a very cultural thing. It is a belief in one's luck. It is belief in feng shui. It's belief in superstition. And it's also a case of, even from my early childhood, and I'm ethnic Chinese, although not born in China. From our childhood, you know, we were allowed to gamble once a year. during Chinese New Year. You know, the friends would get around, the cousins would get around, and we would bring out a deck of cards, our hongbao or red pocket money, and play 21 or whatever the local version is of baccarat at that time. So it's a part belief, part culture, and part basically our outlook on life.
Okay, great. Thank you for this cultural explanation. I think that's really interesting to see. Can you explain to us, like, I guess for the past 10, 15 years, you have like all this massive middle class of Chinese ready to go out and and be tourists and basically have fun and maybe going to casino. So can you guys give us like a brief view on how like all those countries surrounding China, they thought about, oh, maybe we can cash in on those population?
I mean, it seems like, you know, a lot of the countries and jurisdictions that have sought to capitalize on this, and I'm sure Alan can speak in more detail about the Philippines, but certainly in places like Cambodia and these sort of rebel-held regions of Myanmar, a similar sort of project in Laos, which is, you know, run by an ethnic Chinese businessman. You know, all of these projects have sprung up opportunistically, you know, in the interstices of state power. I mean, these are jurisdictions in which regulations are weak, the rule of law is very weak, and which there is a lot of scope for, even though, you know, there might be rules on the books about, you know, banning locals from gambling, it is something that is, you know, there is scope for these things to be established. And so this region has acted as a sort of sponge for the excess demand that exists within China. And we're talking, you know, even if only a small percentage of China's population are interested in gambling sort of in these sort of illicit zones, we're still talking about a huge number of people and a huge amount of money. And so, you know, for everybody from sort of organized crime groups in Sihanoukville in Cambodia to, you know, casino concessionaires based in the borderlands of Myanmar and Laos have seized on this opportunity to set up gambling operations and casinos and attract people. Very often LinkedIn, I mean, Aladdin, your series looks at all of the vices. In places like Mong La and the Golden Triangle Special Economic Zone in northern Laos, you know, there is an entire package. There's gambling, there's prostitution, access to drugs, you know, access to endangered wildlife products and exotic meats. All of these things are wrapped into a package, which for a small minority, you know, a very small minority of Chinese consumers has sort of an attraction.
You just mentioned, Sebastian, Sihanoukville, just to give some concrete number and example to the listeners, because at the World of Chinese, we actually had a reporter on the ground in early 2020. Like, she went to the coastal cities of Sihanoukville in Cambodia, and there, like, she met several Chinese casino worker. And what's interesting is that, like, to give a low scale example of how the industry really helps out people is those casino worker, they were earning like 20,000 RMB. So that's roughly $3,000 per month. And to give you a perspective, that's twice the salary of a delivery driver here in Beijing. And at the same time, the town of Sihanoukville racked up 25% of its tax revenue from the hundreds of casino that were in the town. So yeah, you could really see the amount of money pouring in. And Sebastian, like, can you, because you've been in the ground, I don't know if Ben Lee went to some shady casino or Alan, if you did the same thing in the Philippines, but Sebastian, can you tell us your personal experience on when you went to those really interesting places, those hub of vice?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, so they're, the atmosphere in each of these places is fairly similar. I mean, you have large groups of mostly male Chinese nationals, often with sort of short cropped hair and black t-shirts, smoking, chain smoking, you know, some of them have tattoos. You know, this is the sort of clientele that these attract. We're not talking about, you know, the sort of, when I lived in Chiang Mai in northern Thailand, there's a lot of Chinese tourists there, but they were families going on vacation sort of. But, you know, in these casino zones, it's a very narrow demographic of young men who want to go and indulge in, you know, in the various vices that are available. Sihanoukville has a slightly broader clientele because of the proximity of the beach. So I did see a fair few couples there, but, you know, no children. You know, it's very much an adults only sort of arrangement there. The casinos are mostly small establishments, you know, with bearing sort of these Vegas-esque names like, you know, the Lisboa or the MGM Grand, you know, these sorts of things. And inside, you know, there are, you know, there's sort of a pall of cigarette smoke. And yeah, it's a sort of very quiet people, you know, concentrating intently on each turn of the cards. You know, there's a sort of chilly atmosphere in these places because, as Ben suggested, you know, people take The people that go to these places to game, you know, they take it incredibly seriously. You know, they're it's not a light sort of entertainment sort of atmosphere. It is, you know, there is a lot of money at stake. You know, people in Cambodia and Sihanoukville, I saw with stacks of $100 US bills. You know, so there is, yeah, a lot at stake.
And yeah, but talking about the market in Sihanoukville, we actually did two studies, and what we found that to your point, the market in Sihanoukville in 2018 was not the beach goers, it was not the backpackers, it was not Thailand, as another American analyst have suggested, was the market. The market in Sihanoukville was actually the army of mainland Chinese staff that were working in the online gambling industry in Sihanoukville. Estimates of around about, I think it was around about somewhere between 50 to 80,000 mainland Chinese were living and working in Sihanoukville at its peak in 2018, before the ban on online gaming. Now, why do you need the mainland Chinese? Simply because it reflects the market they were targeting. They were targeting the mainland Chinese market. And what they do is these young mainland Chinese, usually aged in their mid to late 20s, their job was to basically populate the social forums in China through WeChat, pretend to be part of the social groups, and then try and entice their peers into gambling on this this online site that they go, and eventually from there get them hooked on gambling. You can't use any other ethnic Chinese. They've tried it in the Philippines, they've tried local Filipino Chinese, they tried Taiwanese, they tried Vietnamese Chinese, but they cannot fool the mainland Chinese because the accents are different, the idioms they use are different. Philippines, similar to Sihanoukville, had a huge online gambling industry. It basically grew dramatically. And at one stage, I think the estimates of about 100,000 mainland Chinese were working in the online gaming industry in Manila. However, because of increasing attempts to tax these online operators, it drove them back out to other countries like Myanmar and Laos, and even as far as the country of Georgia in Eastern Europe. So it's a bit of flux, and Alan will probably be able to tell you more about the dynamics that's going on between politics and business over there.
Those people who were displaced from Sihanoukville, well, they ended up, they showed up in Manila, and it was an explosive growth that took place during the advent of Duterte's administration. And the promise that his administration gave was that we would earn billions and billions of dollars from these POGOs. But the reality was that these POGOs came here and started flooding the market and edging out the call centers. And they got priority. But instead of being regulated or paying taxes, very few of them did. When the Congress started an investigation, they discovered that there might have been up to 200 POGOs in this country, but only 7 of them were actually paying taxes. It caused a lot of uproar, at least from the point of view of congressional investigations, who were beginning to question what was the purpose of these companies when they were not bringing any money. Instead, what they were bringing in was a flood of Chinese workers. And these workers were meant to man these computers and entice players in China. Some sources have told me is that there were up to 300,000 Chinese here. There was a sort of a cycle involved because, as Ben pointed out, many of these workers would themselves be playing and gambling. And some of them who had hard luck and ended up with huge gambling debts, they were demoted down to the level of what? Criminal. They became thugs and they became goons. And they became hired muscle. And they worked together with Philippine police to go after, I don't know, other Chinese victims, like to go indulge in a bit of kidnapping.
Okay, just to step back, Alan, can you just redefine what is a POGOS?
Maybe I can help Alan there. So POGO stands for Philippine Online Gaming Operator. It's a way for PAGCOR, the government regulator, to legitimize online gaming operators. Now, what the POGO operators do is they hire a studio in the... what do you call those buildings that are certified for online call operations, Alan?
All I know is that they're in the business district, but
yeah, there were originally five buildings: Phil Lam, Burgundy Tower, and so forth, that were originally certified for online call centers. They're special economically zoned to provide tax benefits. So for every official POGO operator, they are in the vicinity of 10 or more service providers. So what the POGO operators do is they will go and hire a building where the internet backbone is really good, really fast. They'll set up little booths, partitions, and they will have mini tables with dealers dealing in those booths, and the video is being streamed. And then they will stream it out via VPN to China. And basically the activities of the service providers are not licensed, nor will anyone be able to see what happens there. And that's where the bulk of the gaming revenue is untaxed. So when the Philippine Congress tried to tax the officially licensed POGO, I think it was like a huge, it's a percentage of every bet rather than revenue. That drove a lot of the official POGO operators away from Philippines.
So what happened to the service providers?
They're going to other places like Georgia.
So before COVID, you had like hundreds of millions of Chinese travelers going all around the world and in Asia. Ben, you were telling me that before this recording and during our pre-interview, you told me that if you wanted to open a casino, then you had to think about like Chinese tourists coming in and, you know, so that your place could be successful. But now that the border are closed, the question is like, how did the COVID impacted the industry? Because I would have thought like, oh, people cannot come in and out of China, but then apparently like the online gambling industry basically took over.
Okay, there are two parts to that question there, Alan. Aladdin. So the first part is where we wrote feasibility studies in all parts of Asia, particularly in Indochina, where locals are not allowed to gamble. And even in Malaysia, you know, there are a lot of restrictions that local Muslims are not allowed to gamble, only the Chinese can, etc., etc. And even in Singapore, you know, they have to pay an entry levy and so forth. Where you do not have access to the local market, then obviously you got to look outside of the local market for your revenue. So in Australia, if you can get 90% of your revenue from your local market, that's your bread and butter. And the same model applies to the US. And then you look at the VIP for your, basically for your cream. Now in Asia, we flip the model on its head. Essentially, if you can get the Chinese, particularly the VIPs, and account for 90% of your revenue, that covers your overheads, your costs, and your required return on profit. Where the cream is, if you can, by virtue of your destination, you know, if it's a very popular destination like Hoi An in Vietnam, if you can get the mass Chinese to come as well, that's your cream. So it's a model that's flipped on its head. Now, with COVID shutting all forms of travel, from outbound travel from China, China looking like even if travel was to resume after COVID has been not overcome but handled, the VIP model is no longer applicable because it looks increasingly like China will no longer allow their people to travel overseas to gamble, not even to Macau. Now, when they do eventually open up international travel to the Philippines or to Vietnam or to Cambodia, they will be under scrutiny. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, a plane load bound for Cambodia had 50% of the passengers stopped from boarding the flight on suspicion of either being involved in the online gaming industry or going to Cambodia to gamble. So the outlook for regional and international travel for gambling is looking extremely bleak.
But how will you stop these young Chinese who were hired by the POGOs here in Manila from traveling when they say they're going to work in Manila? How does the Chinese government plan to regulate that?
Oh, they'll stop them just like that. Chinese officials informed the Philippine government on three, if not four, separate occasions that they identified mainland Chinese nationals working in the POGO industry. They canceled their passports and told the Philippine government, please round them up. This is where they're staying. We will send a chartered jet to pick them up. And they did that. Their undercover agents are prowling the grounds in the Philippines. So they know where they are. They know who they are. if they have the slightest suspicion that these people are involved in the online game industry, i.e., as you said, they're young, they're male, or, you know, they've got no reason to go to the Philippines, even, you know, for whatever reason, they will not issue them with a visa, or they will stop them at the immigration on their way out.
I was going to add, you know, there's also been an effort in the name of COVID containment along the border with Myanmar to, you know, essentially fortify the border, to build a fence. I believe it's about 500 or 600 kilometers of the border is now being essentially fenced in, complete with razor wire and CCTV cameras to prevent the sort of, you know, unregistered movement of people across that border. So when I went to Mong La, I actually paid a motorbike driver to take me through into China illegally. I wasn't intending to. I asked to go to see the border, and he took me across the border. And then I went straight back again, obviously. But there was a conduit that sort of sustained Mong La. And I think local officials in Yunnan, either at the county level or at the province level, you know, were happy for that situation to exist. The question is, though, you know, based on what Ben's saying and what I've heard about the fortification of the border with Myanmar, is whether, you know, Beijing's patience for these sorts of operations, and of course the sort of slow draining of you know, ill-gotten gains from the Chinese state because of corrupt officials going to gamble, has finally run out.
You know, when you mentioned ill-gotten gains, there was a South China Morning Post article earlier this year where one online operator confided in the SCMP journalist, I think it was $130 billion that the industry enjoyed. And then subsequent to that, China's, media mouthpiece came out and said that, you know, they identified 1 trillion renminbi being lost out of the economy due to the online gaming industry.
I gotta say, that's pretty fascinating. Regarding the future of casino, so recently casino operation in Macau have faced some issues. So Ben, can you elaborate a little bit on this?
So basically the Macau casinos operate in, I wouldn't call it a legal vacuum. So what the casino operators do and what the junket operators do in Macau are perfectly legal under Macau law. Now, the problem is our largest market, which is China. As you mentioned earlier, Aladdin, it is illegal to promote gambling in China. It is illegal to organize people to travel abroad for the purposes of gambling. So the casino operators utilized junkets, who basically come in and fulfill a necessary evil. They are the ones to promote Macau in China. They're the ones to identify players and help bring them out to Macau. And more importantly, they are the ones who help the players move their money out of China into Macau or Hong Kong. And for a long time, that has been tolerated by China, not just with the new industry, but even before that, even before liberalization under Stanley Ho days. So why this sudden move to stop what's an essential part of Macau's economy? I think it's, again, this is pure personal opinion. I think factor number one is that with COVID, economy or China's economy or its growth is definitely slowing down. And we've seen several indicators of that in the press. The stopping of the flow of funds out from its economy has become essential or a critical part of their strategy to prop up their economy. And as I said, you know, the trillion renminbi outflow and all that, if you take the metrics and essentially the amount of money that had to flow or that theoretically flowed from China to Macau had to be. And now you can start to understand why China needed to stop the junket industry, but also, you know, to cut down on the size of the gambling industry in Macau. So the economy was one. And the second thing was that, you know, there were a lot of arguments that China would never disrupt the gambling industry in Macau because it was a symbol to be held up for Hong Kong and Taiwan. Well, I think we can all safely say that Taiwan is no longer part of the, it's gone its own way and it's no longer a concern in terms of holding up a beacon. Similarly with Hong Kong, I think that, and again, this is a personal opinion, that the willingness to disrupt the gaming industry in Macau is basically in full view for everybody to see.
So in light of all this conversation, can you all give us a prediction of what will happen in the future regarding the gambling industry?
Well, assuming that the Chinese government's crackdown is enduring and serious, I think we can expect a lot of these operations to dry up, to convert themselves into potentially sort of more vanilla tourism operations. I think one good example, one potential example, is the special economic zone at Botan in the north of Laos. Now, this was a region, an SEZ that in the mid-2000s, you know, became a gambling boomtown very, very quickly, and just across from the across the Chinese border inside northern Laos. And the Chinese authorities subsequently switched off the power, essentially, to the town, and it entered a sharp decline. But the town of Botan has imagined itself in, you know, as a gambling-free logistics hub and tourism destination. And, you know, and I interviewed one of the Lao officials that's involved in the project, and he said that they learned their lesson about, you know, getting involved in gambling. And now that, of course, is also the crossing point for the high-speed railway, which has just been opened, that links the city of Kunming to the Lao capital, Vientiane. So, you know, this could be a potential, future for places like Sihanoukville, that all of this infrastructure, the hotel infrastructure and entertainment facilities and restaurants that have been established, a certain number will close, potentially, a certain number will also be converted into, you know, more straightforward tourism facilities. But a lot depends on the decisions that are made in Beijing as to, you know, how this crackdown unfolds, how serious they are about going after everybody.
I think gambling is going to continue here. We have a centuries-old tradition of gambling going all the way back to when the Spaniards first arrived here and then the Chinese carried on trade with them. So both of these were gambling peoples, and the Filipinos themselves are no slouches when it comes to gambling. So I think that's a mix that will guarantee that there will be no end to Chinese gambling in the Philippines. There are rumors that the reason why Boracay was spruced up was that the government plans to turn it into a gambling center. And one government crony has converted an entire small island near Cavite off Manila Bay into a huge complex of pogo, what would you call them, centers. If you see it from satellite or from drone views, it's just one vast complex of buildings that are going to be devoted to pogo operations. So I don't think there's any pulling back from this.
So I think the face of the industry has changed. And in fact, we are advising our clients. We're involved in a couple of other projects, and we're already advising our clients that we need to relook at the regional business model that we had prospected for them in light of what's happening in Macau. So using Macau as a base case, I think there's already consensus that the terms for the new gaming concessions will be that the new concessionaires will have to invest significantly in non-gaming amenities. They will have to invest in theme parks, they will have to invest in entertainment, maybe even entertainment, recording studios, anything other than just a standard casino, hotel and a few shops. And the place for Macau to do that will be Hengjin Island. So looking at Macau, China appears that they're no longer willing to tolerate, even in their own jurisdiction, for gambling to be a core attraction. They don't mind their mass going as part of an overall entertainment holiday, but not going just purely and predominantly to gamble, which has been the past for Macau and a lot of the other regional destinations. And China has already announced a blacklist, not once, but three times. They haven't specified which countries are included in the blacklist, But what we theorize is that the blacklist is not just about jurisdictions, but also different tiers of treatment. So, for instance, Macau is probably on the lowest tier because it's part of China. Yes, we will allow tourists to go to Macau. We will allow business people to go to Macau. But every visa has to be approved. And then, you know, even then, we got to check and vet every step of the way. And then you got places like the Philippines where, you know, as Alan mentioned, there's soft power in play, you know, trying to get Philippines on side with the, particularly with the island issue in the background, and try and maintain a balance of that versus island versus money issue. And the same with Cambodia, also another soft power issue, because Cambodia has always been an ally of China, but at the same time, you don't want the online gaming industry to get out of hand, which it did. And then you have Australia, which are basically on the shit list. You know, they are no friends. We don't need them. They're probably on the highest tier, i.e. no tourists, no students. And why do we need our businessmen going to Australia? So, you know, we're likely to have different tiers of treatment. And the only thing I can say to finish off this podcast is that if China is willing to stop and to control and to monitor their people going to Macau, which is a new province or a new jurisdiction of China, what's there to say that they will not do even the same, if not even more, for other jurisdictions in the region with gambling destinations?
It's already hard to get a passport for people to leave China unless they have like a really valid reason, like to work or family reasons or to be a student. No one can renew their passport as easily as they wanted to. And yeah, I think it's really interesting to see that how at the end, like maybe people from the gambling industry might have to go and tap into the entertainment. So us at China Compass Production, like we are a specialist in finding you the right talent in mainland China. So if you need some people in the entertainment industry, you know who to call. And
yep.
Joke aside, thank you guys. Now we're going to go to the last part of the show, my favorite, the quiz, where we'll see who is the most knowledgeable among our guests. So I will ask you a few questions. If you know the answer, you have to buzz in with your name. And obviously, the person with the most points will win the quiz. And the winner of the quiz will win the latest issue of The World of Chinese, Access Wanted. So first question, which Hong Kong movie can be considered as the most famous Asian film about gambling?
Alan, God of Gamblers.
Yes, indeed. It is God of Gambler. Yes.
Nice work. I had no idea.
Okay. It's with Andy Lau and Chow Yun-fat. It's a 1999 Hong Kong action comedy drama. That movie, from that story, they made like 10 remakes and sequel and prequel. Like it's yes. Really amazing.
Yes.
Second question. Can any of you define what is stone gambling?
No idea.
No idea.
Sebastian, I think you would have been the one who could have known the most. But okay, no one knows. So what's happening is that along the Myanmar-China border, there is a trade of jade. And sometimes, instead of buying the finished product, merchant would just buy the stone, a rough jadeite. And when they open it, they will finally know what the value of the stone. But it's only before, you can only know the value after opening it. So sometimes like people trade stone for millions of yuan. And at the end, when they open the stone, it's only worth a few thousand, or the other way around. Third question, and maybe last, which Chinese company listed on the Hong Kong stock market and that focus on cultural product has been accused by Chinese state media to use gambling practices?
No, I have no idea.
No idea.
All right, so the answer is Pop Mart. Do you guys know this company or?
I do not, no.
So it's Pop Mart. And Pop Mart is a company which main product is a mystery toy box containing a single figurine with different collections. So like if you bought Pokemon cards, you know what I'm talking about. So buyers do not know which figurine they have bought until they open the box. Therefore, you might need to buy several boxes to find the figurine that you want. Also, what makes it so addictive is that the figurines are really cute and it's rather cheap. Like a box is around 20 to 50 yuan, so $3 to $7 roughly. We actually talked about Pop Mart here on Middle Earth. You can tune into episode 51. All right, so Alan, you win the quiz. Congratulations with 1 point.
Yeah, well done. Just for watching the movie, yeah.
Yeah. Don't gamble, Alan.
I'll try not to.
And on that note, we'll wrap up the show, so thank you guys for your time. In the coming up episode of Middle Earth, we should talk about virtual idols here in China, and also how the Chinese winter sports are getting traction as the Winter Olympics are closing in. If you want to help the Middle Earth podcast to grow, you can of course recommend us to your friend, but even more important, you can recommend us topics or guests to have an insight on China cultural industry. It's not always easy to find people willing to talk, and a recommendation would go a long way. Let me remind you that Middle Earth is part of TWC, the World of Chinese Podcast Network. If you want to know more behind the headlines, go to theworldofchinese.com and order your latest copy. Also, if you're impressed by this show's guest and need to find an interviewee for your next documentary piece or use a researcher in China, or to find a specific talent like Ben will probably do for his entertainment show in Macau, you can give us a call. Today's episode was produced and edited by Aladin Faré.
Music by Sean Calvo.
And distributed by the World of Chinese Podcast Network. Hope to see you next time and stay safe. Bye-bye. Looks like our listener are still doing their dishes.
Yeah, all very committed to their workout.
Yeah, for sure.
So, since you're still here, if you want to learn more about Chinese society, culture, history, and language, you should go to theworldofchinese.com or find us on WeChat, and you'll find an amazing array of award-winning, in-depth, original reporting on China and amazing videos and podcasts too.
All right. Well, until the next issue then.